Good evening, and welcome to the Break Free from Your Enabler Role workshop. I'm so excited to be spending this intimate time here with you, all of you actually, live, and I'm really looking forward to getting to know you when I have the opportunity to answer questions and give you feedback during the Q&A. And I'm also so excited to get to know you even more, all of you, for our bonus one-on-one private coaching session that I've offered due to a large demand of people wanting to have a private session as well. So what I'd like you to do is to make that appointment and to have that coaching session. What I need you to do is write Sherry@sgabatherapy.com. That's Sherry, S-H-E-R-R-Y, at sgabatherapy.com to schedule your appointment. So again, that's Sherry, S-H-E-R-R-Y, at sgabatherapy.com. And we'll schedule your one-on-one private coaching session. And we're going to have you do that before the end of February. The offer ends the end of February, so make sure you get into emailing me and we'll set up a time. And I'll send you times I'm available. And again, you know, do this as soon as possible because the offer does end the end of February. Okay, let's move on for why you're all here tonight. If you constantly take on more than you can do, you're meeting the needs of others rather than your own, feeling disconnected from your own feelings, thoughts, and needs, have lost balance among the stresses and strains of life, refuse to end a relationship, even if it's unhealthy or abusive, have low self-esteem, demonstrate an inability to trust, experience boundary problems with friends and relationships, feel responsible for other people's thoughts, feelings, and choices, try to please other people instead of yourself, see other people as the source of your problem, tend to be attracted to needy people, take care of other people by fixing their flaws for them, then you're in the right place. My discussion of enabling behaviors and codependent behaviors will tend to overlap, and in most cases seem like they mean the same thing. Enabling is just one of the behaviors codependents use to feel needed, loved, and validated, in control, gives them a sense of purpose. Like, where would they be if they didn't have that purpose? And if they aren't enabling or being codependent, feels they're being selfish. So I'm thrilled to be here with you. Before we begin, let me be transparent. I'm so much more than a licensed psychotherapist and certified recovery coach. I'm one of you. That's exactly right. I am absolutely one of you, one of the same. A classic codependent and enabler who knows exactly what it's like to be in your shoes. My disease of codependency started a very long time ago. It only reared its ugly head when I found myself married to an alcoholic who no longer was in recovery. I truly made him the focus for a long time. He was my addiction until finally I was forced to wake up because of some health issues. And that's what codependency enabling does. It keeps us from paying attention to our own wants and needs. I need not go into all the gory details, but I did find hope and healing by joining a recovery group just like the one you're on right now. I found a great therapist and worked on past trauma issues and learned the differences between helping and enabling. And together we're going to learn all about that too and so much more. So what is enabling? Enabling does not just mean you have to have a partner or a child that's an alcoholic or addict, although we're going to talk a lot about that. But that is not the only definition. Enabling can infiltrate many relationships, including your friends, your relatives, your partners, spouses, children, coworkers, bosses, neighbors, and even casual encounters. It's any relationship where your way of relating with them is to assume their responsibilities, to fix it for them. And one thing I know for sure, when we stop enabling, This not only helps us and our journey, but it helps the ones we love by encouraging them to use the abilities they innately have in order for them to regain their dignity and self-esteem. One of the things I always used to ask myself to gauge whether I was enabling my husband or helping him was to ask myself, am I supporting his recovery or am I enabling his disease? I think if you take away anything from this course, that should be your meter into whether or not you're supporting his recovery or enabling the disease. Well, that question, of course, is easier said than done. The bottom line is this. If the person you love is perfectly capable of handling a situation on their own and you're doing it for them, then most likely you're enabling them. What you're doing when you enable is you're helping preserve, protect, and maintain the problem, namely their addiction. The other question you might ask yourself is, am I allowing this person to experience the consequences of their behavior? If not, you're again probably enabling. You think you're helping someone avoid pain and suffering, but believe me, by enabling, you're only prolonging the pain and suffering. When I think of my own situation and my ex-husband, I think by my enabling behavior, I postponed his ability to actually get sober. By bailing him out, really what I was doing was keeping him from, you know, hitting his proverbial bottom, which only hurt him and hurt me. A very dear friend of mine who understood what I was going through used to always say to me, Sherry, you're co-signing his behavior when you do things for him that he can do for himself, and you could also be contributing to his demise if you don't allow him to experience the consequences of his behaviors. This is especially true when you're dealing with someone you love who is an addict or alcoholic. Why? Because if they don't experience the consequences of their behavior, they may be more likely to relapse, overdose, or even die. You may be loving them to death. We're not allowing them to experience the full extent of the issues they have. For example, even when my husband and I were separated, I'd give him money for him to put gas in his car so he could make it to work, when the truth was he was using his money for alcohol. In other words, I was giving him money to put gas in his car when really that money should have been for the gas that he was using for alcohol. So I was really, again, postponing the inevitable. I thought I was helping him so he'd get to work, but all I was doing was allowing him to use his money for more alcohol. That was a huge mistake on my part. And this certainly hindered my own well-being and self-respect. But somehow, I felt this false sense of control over this situation, when truly, I really had no control at all. You know, often we believe we can somehow fix or protect the person we love, but the only person we have control over is ourselves. Those we enable will use any excuse they can. They'll blame the past, they'll blame the present, real or imagined letdowns as excuses to be enabled. They're master manipulators at this. They're always involved in some drama that they can't or won't deal with on their own. Underneath your loved one's excuses is really just a deep-seated fear of change, a fear of failure, and most of all, a fear of losing you, the enabler. Now we're going to get into the next section, which is about creating boundaries. The first step to squash your enabling behavior is to begin to get really clear on what are your boundaries. Are you willing to stick to those boundaries and not bend, which won't be easy when your loved one attempts to manipulate you. I remember my husband on numerous occasions asked me to pick him up because he either lost his car because he was too drunk, he didn't know where it was, or he was too intoxicated to drive. I would refuse, and then I'd be met with all this anger with him, usually hanging the phone up on me or telling me if I loved him, I would help him, I would pick him up, I would save him, I would rescue him. I had to exercise my boundary muscle quite often instead of buying into his manipulation. And I'm sure this sounds very familiar to many of you. The truth is I'm not giving into the demands, You're allowing your loved one to grow and to realize there are no consequences, and in time they will learn to navigate through life's trials and tribulations. If your loved one is not willing to endure the results of a particular type of behavior, then they better stop that behavior. Remember what my friend said, stop co-signing that behavior. One opportunity for them to change is to not play their parts for them anymore. There'll always be excuses why your loved one's drinking or acting out or acting irresponsibly. You know, and I keep using this example of an addict or an alcoholic, but think of any sort of enabling behaviors that you're part of in your family. Are you enabling your young children? Are you enabling your teenage children? How about your young adult children? They may not even have an addiction, but there's other types of acting out. Maybe it's that failure to launch, you know, move out, get on with their life, grow up. Think about all the things in your life where you may be enabling. Maybe it's at work. Think about your work environment. You know, where is it in your life that you're letting other, you're doing for others what they can do for themselves? They will manipulate you into feeling guilty about a myriad of things, their childhoods, a history of trauma, or they'll blame it on something or someone outside of themselves. Most people are not handed the perfect childhood or set of perfect circumstances. And it's really up to them to accept themselves as they are, where they are, learning to adjust to whatever situation comes their way. And for ourselves, too. Their job is to learn how to navigate through life's challenges and develop their own survival tactics. That's really what being an adult is. Their journey will be difficult enough, but by adding enabling to the mix, you're just making their journey more difficult. You're also hindering them developing their own sense of identity. One sense of identity comes from discovering who they are through experiences, and self-esteem comes from dealing with life on life's terms, no matter what cards they've been dealt. By doing esteemable acts, that's how we gain self-esteem. By doing things that we didn't think we could walk through, that's how we gain self-esteem. If you block their journey, by enabling, you're hindering them from forming their own identities, and you're chipping at their self-esteem. They don't even know really who they are. They have difficulty finding their authentic self, their authentic voice. By enabling, you're jumping to their rescue and snatching their problems right from under them. You are precluding them from finding out what works best for them. Remember, what works best for you doesn't mean that it will work for best for them. I also remember the advice I got, being told, remember, they have their own higher power watching over them. You have your own higher power, and you're not it. You are not their higher power. They have their own identity and their own path to follow. By doing everything for them, they'll continue to be ill-prepared for life's challenges. Your loved ones are separate, and they're not extensions of you. It's so difficult to discern what is enabling and what is actually helping your loved one. If guilt is in the equation, you are most likely enabling. One of the things that always kept me from sticking to my boundaries was feeling of guilt and believing I could save my husband. And one of the grave consequences of enabling someone you think you're helping is you teach them learned helplessness. They stop doing things that they can do for themselves. And then, more importantly, they lose the motivation to do anything. Your loved ones keep doing things that are irresponsible and unacceptable. And we just keep buying into it, doing things for them anyway. The worst part is we end up keeping all this chaos within ourselves and within our families. And all that does is perpetuate a secret. And we all know we become as sick as our secrets. In fact, by not doing anything or telling anyone of the dysfunction that's going on in your family, you're making your loved one's behavior okay. How many times did you let your loved one drive when you knew you should be driving, but instead, in fear of his anger, you help maintain the delusion that he doesn't have a problem? Often enablers keep thoughts and desires secret for fear of anger or rejection. Another example of enabling is letting your addict adult child live in your home And again, it doesn't have to be an addict child. It can just be a failure to launch adult child or teenager or most likely a young adult. You allow them to live in your home week after week, month after month, year after year, with promises he'll get a job or go to college, but nothing changes. And we know that saying, if nothing changes, nothing changes. We call that the failure to launch syndrome. You've not set clear boundaries. The lie is just perpetuated, making it harder and harder to set boundaries. You've made idle threats, many idle threats, that your adult child needed to get a job, but not following through, your child doesn't take you seriously, and anything you try to reinforce will be ignored. You become a broken record. The best way to speak up and begin setting boundaries is to not nag and not speak in an accusatory tone. Keep what you have to say simple and direct. I love this other saying I used to hear, that no is a complete sentence. You don't have to say anything else, just no. What you're simply doing is setting healthy boundaries and learning how to say no without feeling guilty. You stop buying into the belief that if you were a good mother, you would give your adult child money, or it's your fault your partner is drinking. Then there are the if onlys, if only I was a better mom, if only I was a better dad, if only I was a better child, if only I was a better spouse, if only I was a better cook, if only I was a better housekeeper, if only I was a better worker, if only I would have acted happier, if only I was more helpful, and more accommodating things could be different. If only I would have accommodated things, things would have turned out differently. This guilt is just all manipulation to make you believe you must be doing something wrong. And this is total crazy making. You have this mistaken belief that if only you can say and do things right, maybe the problem will go away. As if you can control, as if you have all that power, which of course none of us have. When you're living in guilt or caught up in denial, you end up making quick decisions that do not serve you or your addict dependent or loved one, when all you really had to do was just say no. Just say, hello, guilt. Thanks for visiting, and now you can leave. Remember, guilt is just a thought. It's just energy. It's just energy coming in, and you can allow it to go. Say hello to it. Make friends with it. No, it's just a feeling. And remember, feelings aren't facts. They're just feelings. Another way to rectify guilt is to take a hard look at what situations and scenarios bring up guilt for you. For example, your addict has lost their driver's license and they have to take the bus, and they plead with you to take them to work because it's too hot to take the bus. Know your boundary that no matter what, you're not giving rides because you know the bus is a perfectly fine means of transportation. And after all, if you give them rides, they're not experiencing the full set of consequences from their wreckage and their behaviors. They have to really learn to hate riding the bus so that that is something that they can learn from, so that the next time they want to go out and use or drink, they'll remember this could actually, if they really think it through, could get me back to taking the bus, which I don't like. It's not about shaming them or blaming them. I mean, one thing I want to say is an alcoholic or addict or someone who is acting out doesn't wake up and say, I want to lose everything. I want to, you know, be kicked out of my house. I don't want to have a car. I don't want to have a job. I want to have to take the bus. They don't wake up with those desires. It's part of the disease. So this isn't about shame or blame. But what it is about is setting boundaries that you can live with, that you're comfortable with, boundaries that make you comfortable in your own skin. And more importantly, you don't have to defend your decisions to not do something for your addict or your loved one. Never feel like you have to provide an excuse or lie out of fear that saying no is going to upset them or anger them. I mean, I'm thinking of my own situation right now with my elderly mother, and I don't know if anybody will be able to relate to this, but we have to say no. We have to take her driver's license away. And I can't be afraid of her anger or her, feeling like we're taking her independence away because I'm in some kind of denial that there's a real problem here. She's getting in car accidents. She can't hear. She can't see out of one of her eyes. I can't allow my fear of her anger to delude me and put me in a place of denial so that I don't make plans so that she's safe on the road and the people around her are safe. That's how deep denial gets because we're so afraid of somebody getting mad at us. That is codependency, that fear someone isn't going to approve of how we feel about something. When, listen, we all have intuition. We all know pretty much what's right and what's wrong. But our fear sometimes is greater than our knowing of the truth. By making excuses, you open the door for more manipulation and another guilt trip can be laid on you. Remember, no is a full sentence. If you feel uncomfortable saying no, try saying something like, I really appreciate you asking me, but I'm unable to help you. Again, I'll say it again. I really appreciate you asking me, but I am unable to help you right now. Or I hear what you're asking me, but this is not something I'm available for. If you are uncertain about what your answer may be, maybe say something like, let me think about it, or let me get back with you. You always have time to contemplate what is best for you. You're never forced to give an answer just because somebody is bullying you for an answer or they're angry. This is something I say to my clients all the time. You have to be comfortable in their discomfort. You know, when your children or when a little child goes to the market and they want candy, you have to be comfortable in the discomfort of them getting upset because they want candy and you have to say no. Where did we learn that we have to make everything nice for everybody else, that no one should be uncomfortable? I'm not sure where that comes from. Well, actually, I do know where it comes from, and we're going to get into that later in this course. But again, more importantly, what you need to know right now is that it's okay when someone else is uncomfortable. That doesn't make you bad. The thing to remember is when you say no with conviction, you avoid your addict dependent asking again for the same thing, where guilt can rear its ugly head again. It also helps to avoid having to say no over and over again. Addicts have an obsessive nature, and they have no problem asking the same thing over and over again until they hear what they want to hear, which can result in you giving in. How many of you have been texted or called ad nauseum? That's their obsessive nature, and they're going to keep doing it until they hear what they want to hear. What's important here is that by setting boundaries, you're showing self-respect for yourself and your loved one, and you're avoiding being part of a cycle of enabling behavior. You'll know you're changing your enabling ways when you start demanding from your loved ones and you stop putting up with unacceptable behavior. That's where freedom lies, when you learn and you realize, I no longer will accept unacceptable behavior in my life. Remember, you only have control over yourself and no one else. You have to know what is acceptable and unacceptable to you, and nobody else knows that but you. And the way you know that is that it's going to match your values and what you believe in. You have to ask yourself, does it fit my value system to keep paying for my child? This is an example, to keep paying for my child's college when he keeps getting F's. Or is it appropriate to bail him or her out of jail? Or would it be in my child's best interest to have him deal with the consequences by maybe sitting in jail for a second? And it's not easy. I have this happen all the time with my clients, parents that have to tell their children to leave because they're using in the home, and it's becoming dangerous and unhealthy and unsafe. They actually have to ask their children to leave. I've never seen more courageous parents who are able to say you need to leave. And they know their children have nowhere to go, or their adult children have nowhere to go, or their teenagers, or whatever. But that's what they have to do. There is no option. If someone keeps asking you for money, remember, you may need those resources for yourself. So you're not being selfish by, again, saying no to a financial demand from others. I mean, it was so sad. I had a woman wanting to take this course, and she wrote me, and she said, you know, I'm the enabler, and I gave the addict, you know, all my money. I can't take this course. I mean, nothing made me sadder than to get an email like that. But there are people out there that do that. They give away everything for their loved ones. And that's really enabling at its worst. It's very important to be aware also of highly emotionally charged situations, such as your loved ones using in your home, where they can become violent or they can become verbally abusive. You have a right in those situations or those circumstances to absolutely detach with love and get out of arm's way from dangerous situations by asking your loved one to leave. Other enabling behaviors are paying your loved one's rent when they're using their money for alcohol or drugs. Your intentions are good. You don't want someone you love homeless, but maybe that's what it's going to take for them to realize the consequences of their addiction and not seeking recovery. Maybe they can find a shelter and experience what living in a shelter is like. What's interesting here is sometimes you enable because you don't want to expose the havoc in your home, or you don't want to be exposed as less than perfect. And this leads to manipulating your family environment to prevent their failings from being exposed. You're so afraid their flaws are a reflection of you. And this is how manipulation on your end is at its best. In other words, you want to put up a front that everything really looks good. When things are not looking good, then it really becomes more about you, right? Are you really trying to help anybody, or are you trying to help yourself look good? Never forget when I told a client who was dealing with codependency, I said, you have manipulation. You're manipulating. Oh, no, I'm not manipulating. I do everything I can. I try to help this person. No, you're manipulating. You're manipulating because, A, you don't want to deal with that person's anger, so you're manipulating and you're giving in. B, you're manipulating because you want everything to look good on the outside. Who are you really trying to help? I think you're trying to help yourself in that case. That's a really hard thing to accept. But that's the beauty of accepting our codependency and our enabling behaviors, is we finally get to look at our part. We get to wake up and go, oh, my God, I'm part of this problem, and now I'm going to get into the solution. So where does childhood trauma play into all of this? The roots of codependency are a reenactment of their dysfunctional families of origin. So the roots of codependency come from reenacting our families, our dysfunctional families of origin. Individuals who come from families where there was abuse, neglect, addiction, mental illness, physical illness, are most likely to grow up as codependents. You know, were you neglected? Were you abandoned? Were your parents physically not available? Were they emotionally not available? If you came from a family where there was abuse, you learned their needs and boundaries. You learned that your needs and boundaries didn't count. You became invisible and probably most likely struggled with low self-esteem. If someone you love is abused, you learn how powerless you are to the abuse going on. So if you watch someone, or you know, you witness someone being abused, you really learn that you were really powerless over that abuse that was going on in your home. You grow up with a lot of anxiety and fear, and you end up duplicating those fears in your own adult relationships. You might marry someone who's abusive. This is what you know. You reenact what you know. It's all you know. It's actually what you're comfortable with. Fear in a relationship appears normal to you because it's all you've ever known. If you came from a family where you were neglected, you become clingy. as an adult. You grew up isolated and alone, therefore always looking to satisfy that craving for love you didn't receive growing up. What I meant to say earlier is you become clingy and needy as an adult. And then you grow up isolated and alone, therefore always looking to satisfy that hunger, that craving for love outside of yourself, the love that you didn't receive in your family of origin. This leads to always doing what others want and enabling behaviors out of fear you won't be needed or won't make your loved one happy. You're so afraid, really, of being abandoned, of being isolated, that you actually give in to behaviors out of fear of being alone or not being accepted or your behavior not being approved of. You turn a blind eye to unacceptable behavior and destructive relationships. Often when a child comes from a neglectful home, they had to earn love rather than just receiving unconditional love. It all had to do with their behavior, their performance. The only way they earned their parents' attention was being perfect, being a good little girl, a good little A student, a sports star. And then you take these roles as high achievers and pleasers into your adult relationships, and you think that's the only way you'll gain love and attention. And when you don't get that love and attention, you become really bitter and resentful. I actually interviewed someone today for a magazine that I published, Recovery Today Magazine, and he's a pretty famous celebrity, and he came from 8 children. And he said that his impetus for becoming an actor was because of his desire for attention. It's really interesting. So you may not have been neglected or abused, but you might have come from a really large family. And he happened to have been the baby of the family. And, you know, the attention came from getting too much attention by being babied and then no attention by his parents because he was already the 8th child. So he grew up as sort of someone needing attention. Children that come from a home where addiction exists teaches them how to be good little caregivers. This is the only role they see themselves in as they grow up. I had a girlfriend I grew up with. She was all, her mother worked, and her mother didn't really take care of the home, sort of neglected the home. So my friend became the little housekeeper, the little cook, you know, really kind of became this parentified child. Well, what do you think that leads to? Then you grow up and you end up being, you know, an adult with these parentified child issues, and then you become, all you know is to be a caregiver. And it's really interesting the way the universe works, because you end up attracting predators, people that are attracted to you because they know you're going to take care of them. It's fascinating. It's like we're magnets out in the universe. You know, we're the caregiver, and then they're the predator looking to be taken care of, and you sort of find each other. It's like love at first sight. This is the role that they see themselves in as they grow up, little caregivers. And they'll do all the giving in their relationships, neglecting their own self-care. They don't even know who they are or what their purpose is without this caretaking role. That's the beauty of getting through this codependency enabling, is suddenly you wake up and say, why am I here? What is my purpose? What do I want to do with my life? It's fascinating how you have really let all of that go for somebody else so that you'll be accepted, so that you'll feel needed, so that you'll feel important. Families where there might have been many siblings left little attention spent on them. I actually mentioned that earlier. Again, leaving them always feeling invisible and neglected, always hungry for the attention they never got. And again, this isn't, and I'm going to keep saying this, this isn't about shame or blaming your parents. I'm not about that. It's just a fact. A fact is that there were a lot of kids, and by the time it got to you, there just wasn't time for you, or there were just too many kids in the house, and there just wasn't the time to give every kid the same kind of attention. And then there's a child that could have come from a strict home feeling controlled, and they'll turn around and want to control everything when they grow up. I think of really authoritative homes. I think of homes, and again, it's not to stereotype, but I think of homes where maybe the dad was an Army sergeant, you know, and he ran his home like an Army sergeant. And the kid grows up being very controlling and controlling to everyone around him. So now let's get into, again, this idea of not wanting your family exposed is often a result of growing up in your own dysfunctional, less than perfect family of origin. You'll do anything to look good. I think of my own family. My mother came from highly neglectful parents. They were gamblers, and their idea of a Sunday outing was a poker game in their apartment on a Sunday. My mother got no attention. By today's standard, the Department of Children and Family Services probably would have removed her. She was physically abused. My grandfather broke her nose. And my mother worked very hard to make everything look really good in my home. I mean, I'll never forget, I moved in. I was in my 30s. I had gone through a divorce, and she had beautiful furniture. And you know, and I give these examples because it may help you understand how codependency enabling and control and coming from trauma, you know, kind of can manifest in so many different ways. But I'll never forget, she had these beautiful pillows, and she got really mad at me because I didn't make the pillows look like rabbit ears, where you take your hand and you kind of karate chop the pillow and you sort of have these little ears. And she's like, don't you know how to make these pillows look beautiful, you know? And I'm like, Mom, you got to be kidding. Seriously? Who's going to look at these pillows? But that was like her need to have everything look perfect. So always embarrassed or afraid to reveal the chaos that went on inside your own home, you try to make everything look good on the outside. And then you grow up, and you take those fears with you by hiding, manipulating, and enabling everything and everyone around you for fear that your imperfect and messy life might be revealed. And only when you get real honest and allow others to really know you can real healing begin. Childhood trauma and shame are definitely precursors to codependency and enabling behaviors. Because when you grow up in this type of home where there's dysfunction or neglect or abandonment, you carry a lot of shame with you. And I think of my ex-husband who, they were so poor, the social workers would bring a turkey for Thanksgiving. And, you know, he just gets so embarrassed so easily. And it's like, well, where did that come from? Well, it came from always having the neighbors, you know, what he believed, people looking at him, you know, people were judging him. He had buck teeth. What if you grew up and you were really short or you had bad acne? You know, you grow up with this shame that you don't look good enough. You're not enough. And then you take this on into your families, and then you want everybody around you to be good enough and to look good enough, to destruction, to enabling them to make everything perfect, to make everything look good. Being a pleaser was one of the ways that you come from neglect and abuse. This is how you cope with your dysfunctional families of origin. And when giving into other brings rewards and safety, this way of reacting is reinforced and is continued into adulthood as enabling. Then when you people please, you get this pat on the back, that a boy, that a girl, which boosts your self-esteem. Just remember, enabling can make your loved ones feel incompetent. You may feel good because you're doing something and you're getting that pat on the back, but believe me, you're just reinforcing your loved one to feel more insecure and more incompetent. And in addition, often when you enable, you end up swallowing your anger, suppressing or ignoring your own personal needs, and that's where resentment rears its ugly head. And this is just a total recipe for resentment and bitterness. Enabling others teaches your loved ones the world will always be there to accommodate them. Then they have little to no motivation to change, with their enablers continuing to sweep up their messes. Their enabler ends up holding things together, covers for them, and protects them from the consequences of their behavior, which is a recipe for disaster. So let's take a moment and look at mindset. Look at our mindset and how that affects our enabling behaviors. As some of you may know from my book, I wrote a book called The Law of Sobriety, Attracting Positive Energy for a Powerful Recovery. I'm a big believer in the law of attraction. we create our realities by the thoughts we put out into the universe. Part of eliminating enabling is changing your mindset with new thoughts. New thoughts allow you to create new emotional reactions and new actions. So the first step is to accept your actions and emotions has often been based on guilt and shame and manipulation by the addict or your loved one, which has resulted in your enabling behaviors. So take a look at the thoughts that surround those enabling actions and see if you can look at things from a different perspective or point of view. So maybe just take 1 second here for a moment and just kind of notice what type of thoughts you have that cause you to enable or to do for others what they can do for themselves. Just maybe take a second, maybe jot down some notes. They may not feel very natural because your thoughts and actions have always been around enabling. But once you get past the discomfort, you can handle things in a completely new way. Your default mindset has always been to give in. And now you're changing it up by saying no. And you're going to learn how to set boundaries. And it's going to feel really strange for a while doing things differently. But that's where real growth can take place for you and even your loved ones. We sort of have a default mindset. You know, the default is to do what we've always known. So it's like moving to the edge of the unknown, getting past that unknown, getting to the other side, instead of going back to your default position of doing things as you've always done. And you'll know that you've reached that default or that edge when you're starting to feel really uncomfortable. When you start to go down the path of feeling guilty or see enabling in the horizon, say things to yourself like, don't go there, stop, think, hold it. Don't go there, stop, think, and hold it. These are great thought stoppers. You can even write them on notes. Write them on your hand. They're thought stoppers that to reprogram the way you think. And then ask yourself, is this helping or enabling? Again, I'm going to tell you that's probably the best sentence of the whole course is to ask yourself, is this helping or enabling? Is this supporting his recovery or enabling his disease? Is this my responsibility or theirs? Is this my responsibility or theirs? Again, your new way of thinking may feel very uncomfortable, but it's important to be comfortable in your discomfort. Another issue that may come up is you become the enemy for not rescuing your loved one by standing your ground. When my ex-husband refused to take his belongings after 3 years out of my garage, I had to have them removed. Everybody was angry at me. He was angry at me. His family was angry at me for doing this. But 3 years was long enough. I had to endure their anger and disapproval and be okay with that because I knew I was doing the right thing. It's really important to look at what your motives are. If I would have not thrown his things out, I would have been just trying to avoid the backlash from my ex-husband and his family. I would have been buying into people-pleasing, a huge codependent trait. I knew that I had to be comfortable in the discomfort of them not accepting my decision to get rid of his things, and that had to be okay. The truth was, keeping his things in my garage was really my way of connecting to him and his way of connecting to me. And that's getting really honest. Shattering the connection of the enabler-dependent relationship was a huge threat to both my ex-husband and myself. And he didn't have the money to put his things in storage because he was using that money for drinking. I was enabling his drinking by keeping his things in my garage for a very long time. I'm going to read some affirmations, and you can repeat them after me. They're great affirmations for your new belief system. So they say these affirmations twice a day, post them all over your house to remind yourself of your new mindset. So repeat after me. I have a right to set new boundaries. I have a right to set new boundaries. I have a right to say no. I have a right to say no. I have a right to not feel guilty. I have a right to not feel guilty. And definitely repeat them after me. Even though I may feel guilty, even though I may feel guilty, this is just a temporary emotion and it will pass. This is just a temporary emotion and it will pass. I can only change and control my own actions. I can only change and control my own actions. I can make different choices when I find myself enabling. I can make different choices when I find myself enabling. I may feel uncomfortable setting boundaries and saying no, but this discomfort will pass. I may feel uncomfortable setting boundaries and saying no, but this discomfort will pass. I am choosing to help those I love versus participating in enabling behaviors. I am choosing to help those I love versus participating in enabling behaviors. It's healthy for my loved ones to experience consequences for their behaviors. It's healthy for my loved ones to experience consequences for their behaviors. I want the best for my loved ones, and by setting boundaries and saying no, I'm helping them grow. I want the best for my loved ones, and by setting boundaries and saying no, I'm helping them grow. By setting boundaries, you're letting your loved ones know you want them to be all they can be, with or without you. So before I forget, though, do remember to write me at Sherry, S-H-E-R-R-Y, S-H-E-R-R-Y, at sgabatherapy.com, Sherry, S-H-E-R-R-Y, at sgabatherapy.com. I am going to be doing 30-minute live coaching sessions with each and every one of you. I'm really excited to get to know you. Write me, and we'll schedule time to have that appointment, that life coaching session. Now we're going to get into the subject of codependency. So why do we enable? One of the reasons is pure denial and excuses we make for our loved ones. Some of those excuses are they must be using or drinking because of low self-esteem, they're under stress, they're in a bad relationship, unemployment or financial problems, maybe a traumatic childhood. These are all excuses. The bottom line is this. Addicts and alcoholics drink because they're alcoholics or drug addicts. The truth is all these negative things that are happening to them is because of the drinking and using. They're not the causes. These are all just excuses. It's not your job to fix their problems, play therapist, or resort to feeling sorry for them for a difficult childhood. So what is at the root of enabling and codependent behavior? Well, I'm sure you've already figured that out. It's codependency. We're going to spend some time on the subject of codependency and dive a bit deeper into this addiction, because really it is an addiction. that person that we love, that we're enabling, becomes our addiction, our obsession. The truth is codependency is a disease just like alcohol and drug abuse is. And if we don't exercise our muscles of codependency recovery, codependency is going to continue to ruin our lives and the lives of those we love. So by being on this call and taking part in this workshop, this is one of the first best steps you can take in your recovery process. And it's exactly what I did. And that's how I became healthier and moved past my codependent and enabling behaviors. And I even worked in the field. And I even, you know, but it, until you experience it, until you're living with it, it's not the same thing as working in the field. And as you can see by my call, I like to be very transparent. I like to be very honest. I think that's how we all hope and heal, by sharing what's real and true. Also, continuing on with a support group is the second best step you can take for healing. That's what I did, and you can too. I'll be talking later about an intimate support group beginning after this workshop ends, and I do hope you'll join me. Codependency is an addiction in and of itself. The bottom line of codependency is not having a relationship with yourself. Codependents believe they can control people, places, and things outside of themselves. And because they are so focused on those things outside of themselves, it keeps them from looking at their own issues that exist in their own lives. Some of the issues underneath codependency include low self-esteem, extreme fear of abandonment and rejection. Codependents often pick partners or continue to enable their children out of their poor sense of self-worth. They're actually looking for enabler-dependent relationship to build their own self-esteem. Sometimes to continue to the dysfunctional bond between the codependent enabler and the dependent addict alcoholic, they'll sabotage their dependence by treating them as helpless and fragile. Sometimes enablers fear their dependents might not need them if they get sober or get emotionally healthy, and then they'll no longer be needed. So unconsciously, they're holding on to their dependence out of fear of being abandoned, which is at the root of their feeling of emptiness and unworthiness. Codependency can apply to anyone who has difficulty taking care of their own needs and wants and focus exclusively on the other person, whether a partner, child, in their work environment, and even in their friendships. Codependents have such low self-esteem, they'll tolerate all sorts of inappropriate behaviors just so they don't lose someone, or a profound fear they won't be needed. Let's see. Lori, are you there? We're ready to do the Q&A.
Hi, Sherry. I'm here. Right. For those of you who are on the phone lines, you can hit *2 on your phone, and it'll raise your hand, and I'll be able to see that you have your hand raised. For those of you who are on the webcast, there should be a Ask Sherry question box or a box where you can put in your question. You can type it in. Make sure you send along your first name, and we'll get it on this end. It takes sometimes, you know, up to a minute to get it, but please don't hesitate doing that because Sherry would love to help you since we're doing this. And I'll pass it over to you. So, again, on the call, it's *2 to raise your hand. And those of you who are on the webcast, there's a box there that you can put. It's usually right down below that you can put your questions in and your first name.
So I'm here, everyone. So definitely don't be shy. I'm here to support you. And just a reminder to email me at sherry@sgabathetherapy.com, S-H-E-R-R-Y at S. GABATHERAPY.com, and we'll set up your private coaching session. You know, we're dealing with a subject that sometimes we're used to being anonymous. We're used to, you know, I even talked about it in the class tonight. You know, we're used to secrets. We're used to just you know, not sharing stuff that's important to share, but we're, you know, we have some shame about it, some blame. We're just not used to it. So I totally understand, but I am here for you.
Oh, we have somebody on the call. Let me unmute them.
Is there somebody there?
Okay. Is that better?
Yeah, I can hear you perfectly.
Oh, there you go. I had to unmute myself.
Okay, no problem.
So all of this is really super great, and I'm going to take a whole bunch of it and be able to apply it to my life in many ways. What sometimes is hard, though, is when you're dealing with somebody who's really not an addict or in recovery. I'm in recovery. My family's completely dysfunctional, and I have a brother who is a little he has some mental health issues.
Uh-huh.
And we all find ourselves just sitting back there and letting him continue to manipulate us. And especially, you know, my mom and myself, where we will just always go and do whatever we can for him because of that fear that if we don't help him and make those decisions for him, he might do something to himself or, you know, he might do whatever. And that's a part that's really hard for me. So how can you apply some of the same logic and teaching that you're saying to help somebody who might have an addiction as opposed to somebody who has maybe more mental health issues that you have to feel like you really watch the boundary line?
That's a great question. And you know, to be perfectly honest, many people that deal with addiction have a mental health issue underneath. So it isn't that unusual when we're almost talking about sometimes the same thing, you know, because often, again, underneath the addiction is the mental health issue. But this person, you know, your brother that you're talking about, first of all, I'm very sorry that he does have these issues. Have you done everything to help support him in terms of therapy and medication and that sort of thing? You know, the basic stuff?
You know, he was very self-sufficient for a long time, and he's always had some underlying mental health problems. And he lost his job about 6 months ago, and my mom stepped in and started controlling everything for him.
Yeah.
And he's currently he was addicted to pain medications and opiates, and he's gone into different treatment programs for mental health issues, but then he had cocaine in his system.
Well, he sounds like an addict to me. He does sound like an addict.
But he'll sit there and just completely deny, saying, oh, I don't want to go to a treatment program if their primary focus is on drug rehab.
So you have to find what's known as a dual diagnosis program, and there are many places.
Yeah, we found a really good one. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no, that's okay. That's what he needs. I mean, I can understand that, you know, this is something much greater than the addiction. It's probably the mental illness that's causing the addiction. You know, he's probably really suffering. So if he's refusing to go, this is where it gets really rough because, you know, if you keep taking care of him and he keeps, you know, kind of bullying you, saying, you know, I'm not going to go, you're really enabling him by taking him in and supporting him if he's not willing to go. In other words, you're willing to support his recovery, you know, whether that be his mental illness or his addiction, but you're not going to take care of him because by taking care of him, and I think what your worst fear is that he might hurt himself or hurt someone else and so forth, but you're actually keeping him from getting well by continuing to take care of him and not insisting that he, you know, and if he isn't willing to go to a program, then he might have to leave. And your mom sounds like she could really benefit from NAMI, which is National Association of Mental Illness, or a really great Al-Anon meeting where she can get other support from other parents. But what I'm hearing is that there is definitely addiction here too.
There's definitely the addiction part.
Yeah.
And we found a really great place, but he's, you know, kicking and screaming. And he will be the first to admit that he knows he needs to make a change, Yes. But he's afraid, but he doesn't know how to do it, and he's afraid to tell my mom no. So they have this constant struggle back and forth, and he's living in our house right now. And
yeah.
I'm trying to figure out how I can step back and say, you guys figure it out, but then I also don't want to just have them figure it out. I want to be able to say, hey, this is what I can do to help. So for me, that's part of my codependency, right, is saying,
right, right.
How
maybe
can I
what
help
you could
you?
Do to start is you could actually, you know, meet with your mom and actually take her to an Al-Anon meeting or take her to a NAMI
okay.
meeting. Or find a professional in your area that's a therapist or someone, you know, or a psychiatrist or someone that can sort of hold both, you know, your hands and sort of help guide you. And maybe what this might look like is an intervention, you know, like get the proper people in your brother's life to do an intervention.
Gotcha.
Does that make sense?
No, that makes perfect sense.
It's the smallest steps that can make the biggest difference. I mean, even going, you know, just going to your mother may not realize because, you know, the truth is you don't realize. I mean, listen, I was really honest in this call. I work in the field, and I didn't know what I was dealing with till it was in my own home. I didn't understand it. I understood the books about it, but I didn't understand what it really looked like. And until you live
yeah.
it, your mom is just doing what she thinks she's supposed to be doing to protect her little cub. She doesn't know any different. She, you know, this is what she thinks she should be doing. But there is another way, and she just doesn't know that other way. She only knows this way.
Yeah.
And this way is probably keeping him really stuck from and keeping him from getting the right help he needs. Maybe he needs, you know, medication, a different medication change or, you know, there's just so much great help out there today. And it
okay.
just starts with that one little step. I hope that helped.
Oh, no, it helps. It helps tremendously. And a lot of it, you know, I know how to kind of try to get her to look at things or hope that I could, but I think going to the meetings is really a good idea, and I hadn't thought about that.
They're great. You know, where I live, they have a really great parent focused. Yours is a little different because he sounds like an adult, not a child. Or, you know,
yeah.
so you really don't necessarily need a parent focus, but, you know, find a really good meeting, and if you don't find, you know, try a couple meetings before you, you know, don't just go to one, you know, if you don't like it, definitely try a few.
Okay. I will do that. Thank you so very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling in. I really appreciated that call. I think it takes, a lot of courage to be open and transparent on a subject like this. It's a really hard subject. So, again, you know, please feel free. And if not, I totally understand. And we're going to have that private coaching session. You can share with me you know, anything that's going on, it's in terms of codependency, enabling, or, you know, even finding your own interests and purpose because you've been, you know, busy sort of taking care of others.
Nothing else coming in, Sherry, but maybe just give them your email again to schedule with
okay.
you before the end of February. And we'll send it out in the email. We'll send an email out. So everybody knows when the recording is available. It'll be available tomorrow, but we'll send you an email, and we'll also include Sherry's email in there so you can schedule, but maybe you can give it out one more time.
Okay, great. It's Sherry, Sherry, at sgabatherapy.com. That's sgabatherapy.com. Please feel free to write me and get that appointment scheduled, that coaching session scheduled. And thank you, everybody, for an amazing call. And I really look forward to being online with you again next Wednesday at 5:30. So have a good night.